This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, April 24th, 2013. In Mountain View, California, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, in Bangladesh, more than 100 workers are killed and hundreds more injured following the collapse of a garment factory building. As activists continue pressure on government officials to pass immigration reform, two significant court decisions this week could affect U.S. deportation policy. And a Yemeni activist travels to Washington to testify at the Senate's first hearing on the targeted killing program. He says drones are killing civilians and making the region more dangerous. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. As Pakistan's caretaker government prepares national elections, violence aimed at secular left-wing candidates and election workers has increased. The past 36 hours has seen 8 elections-related bombings. The Taliban is suspected to be behind the attacks. FSRN's Gabe Matthews reports from Pakistan.
Soon after Pakistan's caregiver government announced it would conduct free and fair elections, Taliban militants issued warnings to 3 left-wing parties. Over the past 2 days, violence against campaign workers has increased. There have been 8 bomb blasts in 3 provinces. 12 people are dead, and dozens have been injured. Ghulam Bilur, a ministerial candidate running as a member of the left-wing Awami National Party, lost one of his brothers in a Taliban bomb attack in December. Bilur escaped that attack, but today his election workers were once again targeted.
I am not afraid of the attacks and killings. I am deeply grieved for the young dead people and my security guard. I openly tell Taliban militants to kill me if you think that will allow you to win power and bring Sharia law. But I beg you to forgive the young people and stop killing these innocent youth.
Elections are scheduled for May 11th. I'm Sean Rang, reading for Gabe Matthews in Peshawar.
The trial of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny got underway today. The face of the Russian opposition movement stands accused of embezzling from a government agency during a timber sale. Navalny and his supporters say the charges are politically motivated. FSRN's Yekaterina Danilova reports.
The case against Navalny is a case against us. Activists chanted at demonstrations in St. Petersburg and other cities today. During the trial, Navalny said criminal allegations were brought because of his work documented corruption in state-owned companies and exposing organized election fraud by the ruling party. He also said the trial is meant to tarnish his reputation.
The most important reason the trial is happening is to create an absolutely deceitful PR campaign to be carried out by the state media. Every day you turn on your television and see a news story about the corrupt Navalny.
If found guilty, Navalny faces up to 10 years in prison. In addition, a guilty verdict would exclude him from ever running for public office. Navalny has said he would like to run for president. The court's ruling is expected in June. Other criminal cases against him are also pending. Ekaterina Danilova, FSRN, St. Petersburg.
French lawmakers have approved legislation legalizing same-sex marriage, joining New Zealand and Uruguay, who both passed similar laws this month. The French campaign surrounding the legislation has been particularly contentious, with incidents of attacks on gays and lesbians rising dramatically in the lead-up to the vote. The bill also allows gay and lesbian couples to adopt children. The Bolivian government is at the International Court of Justice in The Hague today, trying to regain territory lost to Chile more than a century ago. From Cochabamba, Bolivia, FSRN's Aldo Orellana reports.
Bolivia lost more than 400 kilometers of coastline in the War of the Pacific, which ended in 1883. As a result, the country is landlocked. The government wants the International Court to declare that Chile has an obligation to negotiate an agreement in good faith that gives Bolivia sovereign access to the Pacific Ocean. Several Bolivian governments throughout history have attempted to convince their southern neighbor to return the land, but Chile has always refused. Leaders argue Bolivia accepted the loss in a 1904 treaty. Bolivia says it was forced to sign. Bolivia took the case to the international court after President Evo Morales closed the talks with the Chilean government on the issue. Morales says all avenues of dialogue have been exhausted. For his part, Chilean President Sebastián Piñera has maintained the validity of its claim on the land. Aldo Orellana López, FSRN, Cochabamba, Bolivia.
And finally, the two Southern Californian women whose truck was shot nearly 100 times by police chasing ex-LAPD officer Christopher Dorner have settled with the department for $4.2 million. The women, who were delivering newspapers, were in the vehicle when the officers opened fire. Margie Carranza was shot in the back. Her elderly mother, Emma Hernandez, was injured slightly. Their truck was a different make, model, and color from the truck Dorner was reported to be driving. The settlement still has to be approved by the Los Angeles City Council. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Mountain View, California. Rescue efforts continue in Bangladesh, where the collapse of a building that housed garment factories killed at least 100 people and injured more than 600, according to government sources. Labor groups with staff on the ground said they expect the death toll to rise as the facility housed more than 2,000 workers and many are missing. Photos from the scene today showed workers and family members pulling survivors from the 8-story building, one side buried in a mountain of rubble. The garment factories produced clothing for well-known Western brands. According to the International Labor Rights Forum, who cited documents and labels at the site, those include Benetton and Tex, a Carrefour brand. The AP reports that Walmart and Disney also sourced clothing there, though that has yet to be confirmed. Workers at the building said that they had been ordered to report to work today after increasing concerns about a crack in the building this week. The accident comes 5 months after a fire at the Tazreen Fashions factory, which killed more than 100 workers. For more, we're joined by Charlie Kiernigan, director of the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights. He's been monitoring the situation through staff who are on the ground and at the disaster site. Welcome to FSRN.
Good to be here.
Can you first describe the building where this latest accident took place? Was it just factories? Did it have residential areas?
It's called Savar. It's about 25 miles outside of Dhaka, which is huge. But there's an enormous export processing zone in Savar where there are literally hundreds of factories. It a large factory, which was 8 stories high, the building collapsed early this morning, and there are 3,000, over 3,000 people in this factory. God knows how many are going to be accounted for is dead. We know right now 112 workers are dead. The building collapsed at 9 o'clock. It just pancaked. There were 4 or 5 garment factories inside this building. And it's just another shoddy construction where everybody bribes the officials and they can get away with this. And they get away with killing these workers.
And you have people on the ground who your organization is working with. How are they describing the scene today?
Oh, horrific. And, right now, what actually happened, which makes it even worse, on Tuesday, the day before, the workers themselves actually saw big cracks in the building. Now, again, this is an 8-story concrete building. And the workers on Tuesday morning saw these cracks, and they were quite concerned. And, in fact, they didn't go into work on Tuesday. They refused. And a union leader we know, Sujan, a very great guy, he was also with them and said, this looks very dangerous. And then even a local official of the municipality of Savar came in and said, I wouldn't go into that factory. So the workers actually stayed out on Tuesday. When they went back yesterday, which is the morning on Wednesday, the owner of the building said, and the owner of the garment factory said, look, everything's really all right. They were sweet talking the workers. They were saying, look, there's a few little cracks, but that's nothing. It's just cosmetic. We can fix that up. And then they dropped the bomb on the workers by saying, look, if you don't go to work, you're not getting paid. And workers in Bangladesh live from hand to mouth, so they have to live. They have to live. They got to work. So they did go back into the factory on Wednesday at 8 o'clock in the morning when the shift started. At 9 o'clock, the building collapsed.
So you're saying, according to the workers there, they had noticed cracks or evidence of structural damage in the building as recently as Tuesday, and they did report that to authorities.
Yes. And, you know, the problem is that Bangladesh is a very, very poor country. But this could be one of the bigger tragedies ever, with the fires and now with this collapse.
At least one picture shows rescue workers carrying what appears to be a child. What about minors or children? Would they be living or working in this area, in these factories?
Well, I mean, there is a lot of child labor, so we don't know if we'll find out more. It's possible. I mean, there are children workers, so there could be some children working in these factories. There's four or five factories in this building itself. It's a very big building. It also could be that the walls collapsed on the kid outside the factory. We really don't know that yet, but of course there's very young workers in these garment factories.
According to the AP, some of the brands that got products from this site are Walmart and Disney. We did reach out to Walmart. It would not confirm that, but said in a statement that it is investigating its supply chain. Do you have information about what corporations were getting materials or goods from these factories?
Well, in the case of the Tazreen fire, which you may be alluding to, that went back, you know, that was in November 24th, 2012. Walmart originally said that they were not in that factory where the 112 workers were burnt to death. Well, of course they were. I mean, they claimed they didn't know they were in the factory because there was an illegal subcontract. But, I mean, this is the kinds of games that these big retailers play. They want the cheapest goods imaginable. And if it means there's going to be subcontracts going to a place like Tazreen, it's going to happen. And we're going to find out about other labels. It, you know, one of the reasons we're not getting so many labels out of this particular factory right now, the one that collapsed, is because they collapsed and you can't get in there. You can't get the labels out. And the workers told us the labels are sewed on after the garments are actually completed. So we haven't been able to get inside that building to get all of the labels.
But Walmart and other companies are getting supplies, are getting products from that Savar neighborhood, that area around Dhaka.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, yeah, that Savar area is one of the major centers of garment making. And, you know, again, I mean, this is a country where you have unions, but they don't exist. You have very good people, brave, courageous people, but the unions function as non-governmental organizations. They don't have real unions. There's 4,500 garment factories in Bangladesh. We know of one union, one factory, that actually has a union contract. Nobody should be forced to live like that.
Charlie Kiernaghan is director of the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights. He joined us to discuss the deadly collapse today of a building in Bangladesh that houses garment factories. Charlie Kiernaghan, thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir.
A Yemeni activist and writer testified before the U.S. Senate's first public hearing on the use of drones and the Obama administration's targeted killing program. Faria al-Muslimi is from Wesab, a remote mountain village in Yemen.
Just 6 days ago, my village was struck by an American drone in an attack that terrified the region's poor farmers. Wesab is my village, but America has helped me grow up and become what I am today. I come from a family that lives off the fruit, vegetables, and livestock we raise in our farms. My father's income rarely exceeded $200. He learned to read late in his life, and my mother never did. My life, however, has been different. I am who I am today because the U.S. State Department supported my education.
Al-Muslimi attended an American high school, managed the basketball team, won academic awards, and immersed himself in U.S. culture. He befriended a member of the U.S. Air Force, who he said was like a father to him.
Most of my year was spent with him and his family. He came to the mosque with me, and I went to church with him, and he became my best friend in America. I went to the U.S. as an ambassador for Yemen, and I came back to Yemen as an ambassador of the U.S. I could never have imagined that the same hand that changed my life and took it from miserable to promising one would also drone my village.
Two drone strikes were reported in Yemen over the last week. One strike was aimed at the village of Wesab, and more precisely, a man named Hamid al-Radmi. Al-Muslimi said many local people knew al-Radmi, and the Yemeni government or even local security could easily have found and arrested him.
In the past, what Wesab's villagers knew of the U.S. was based on my stories about my wonderful experiences here. The friendships and values I experienced and described to the villagers helped them understand the America that I know and that I love. Now, however, when they think of America, they think of the terror they feel from the drones that hover over their heads, ready to fire missiles at any time. What the violent militants had previously failed to achieve, one drone strike accomplished in an instant.
In his written testimony, al-Muslimi said Wesab's farmers are afraid and angry. They did not know al-Radmi was a target and could have been with him when the drone strike hit, and some who were with al-Radmi at the time of his killing had no connection to terrorist groups. Al-Muslimi stressed to lawmakers that this isn't an isolated incident.
I have spoken to many victims of U.S. drone strikes, like a mother in Jar, who had to identify her innocent 18-year-old son's body through a video in a stranger's cell phone. Or the father in Shakra who held his 4 and 6-year-old children as they died in his arms. Recently in Aden, I spoke with one of the tribal leaders present in 2009 at the place where the U.S. cruise missiles targeted the village of Al-Ma'jala in Lodar, Abyan. More than 40 civilians were killed, including 4 pregnant women.
Concluding his testimony to senators, Yemeni activist and writer Faria al-Muslimi said he deeply believes that when Americans truly know about how much pain and suffering the U.S. airstrikes have caused and how much they are harming efforts to win hearts, minds, and grounds in Yemen, they will reject this devastating targeted killing program. The White House declined to provide a witness for the hearing, and several senators expressed their disappointment and demanded more information from the Obama administration on its legal justification for targeted killing. Retired General James Cartwright joined other witnesses and some senators in calling for more transparency.
I believe that if people understand what the options are and the choices are, and that they are reviewed, and they are basically, as we do in our judicial system, in an adversarial way, looked at with a very jaundiced eye about whether we want to proceed or not to proceed, that we can move in a direction that is far better than where we are today. But I believe that in several areas around the world, the current drone policies have left us in a position where we are engendering more problems than we're solving.
As Congress begins to ask questions about the targeted killing program, activists continue their long campaign to raise awareness about the issue. Protests took place Wednesday outside the Air National Guard base in Battle Creek, Michigan. Local media reported 12 were arrested. And this coming weekend in Syracuse, where peace activists have long been protesting drones at the Hancock Air National Guard base, 3 days of events are planned, culminating in another demonstration outside the base. As the Senate's immigration reform bill goes through several contentious hearings on Capitol Hill, a series of court rulings this week are calling into question how the U.S. currently treats undocumented people. A U.S. district court in California ordered the government Tuesday to grant all undocumented immigrants with mental disabilities legal counsel during their deportation proceedings, while the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that immigrants cannot be deported for minor drug possession charges. The legal decisions come as a coalition of labor and immigrant rights groups called Not One More are demanding the Obama administration halt all deportations of those who could qualify for citizenship in the future. In Washington, D.C., FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Mexican national José Antonio Franco González spent 5 years in immigration detention without a bond hearing or a lawyer, and served a 1-year sentence before that for throwing a rock during a fight, which the court deemed assault with a deadly weapon. Though 33 years old, Franco González has the mental age of a young child due to a cognitive disability. With the help of civil liberties and immigrant rights groups, he successfully sued the Justice Department for denying due process rights to him and others in immigration detention not competent to represent themselves. The U.S. District Court for the Central District of California ruled in his favor this week, saying immigrants with mental disabilities must be assigned a legal representative and given a hearing. Attorney Talia Inlander represented Franco Gonzalez in his multi-year case and said the ruling is a major victory for protecting the rights of the justice system's most vulnerable people.
The consequences in immigration proceedings are equally, if not more dire in some cases. We're talking, you know, about people being permanently banished from the country, being separated from their families, being, you know, sent to countries where there's persecution or torture. And yet the government has taken the position that nobody is entitled to legal representation at the government's expense in those proceedings. And so we amended the complaint and turned the case into a class action so that, you know, what happened to Mr. Franco never happens to anybody again.
Inlander says it's hard to know exactly how many people this ruling could impact nationwide, because Immigration and Customs Enforcement has no procedure in place for identifying which detainees are not able to represent themselves. Inlander, who works with the organization Public Counsel, says she will also advocate for others caught up in the current immigration system who are clearly not able to defend themselves in court.
Young children who are placed in proceedings, and they can sometimes be as young as 2, 3, 4, 5. We're talking very, very young children. We've had very young clients in our office facing immigration proceedings and aren't entitled to a lawyer.
The U.S. Supreme Court also ruled this week that the federal government's current deportation procedures are not constitutional. The case involved a man from Jamaica who came to the U.S. at age 3. He was deported in 2008. When police found a small amount of marijuana in his car and charged him with the aggravated felony of possessing the drug with the intent to distribute it. Under federal law, this meant automatic deportation with no chance of return. The justices ruled 7-2 on Tuesday that the offense was too minor to justify this punishment, meaning Adrian Moncrief can now petition to rejoin his family in the U.S. Moncrief is just one of millions of people deported over the last few years. 2012 marked a record of more than 400,000 deported, an average of more than 1,100 people per day. Even as Congress prepares to overhaul the nation's immigration system, this rate has shown no signs of slowing down.
We are working on an immigration reform bill that's going to potentially put 11 million people on a pathway to citizenship, and we're still breaking families apart as we speak.
That's undocumented activist Lorella Preli speaking outside the U.S. Capitol. Preli, who came to the U.S. from Peru at age 2, cautioned her fellow activists against getting too excited about the immigration reform bill and supporting it uncritically.
It's important to remember every single person that is undergoing a deportation right now, every single family member that is feeling that pains oh so deeply. And so I think our call is for Congress to move on this and to move on this quickly. Our call is for President Obama to use his authority as President of the United States to stop deporting families.
The Senate has been holding a series of hearings on the nearly 850-page bill, including a 7-hour hearing Monday that featured more than 20 witnesses. Only one of those witnesses was an undocumented person who would be directly impacted by the bill. The Senate Judiciary Committee will review the legislation for a fourth time on Thursday, and a vote is expected next month. Alice Holstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
And now we continue our coverage of the outcome of the election in Venezuela. There, Nicolas Maduro is in his first full week after being sworn in as president after the National Electoral Commission declared him the winner in a narrow victory on April 14th. The commission has said an audit of the votes will take about a month to complete, but it doesn't expect the results to change. The U.S. has yet to recognize the Maduro presidency. For more, we're joined by Alex Main, Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He was in Caracas during the election and directly afterwards and joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you. It's great to be on your show.
On Monday, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said that a recount, which the U.S. has called for, is, quote, an important, prudent, and necessary step to ensure that Venezuelans have confidence in these results. Let's take one aspect of that statement first. Is there confidence in Venezuela in the vote outcome?
Well, not entirely, unfortunately, because I would say the opposition and particularly the opposition candidate, Enrique Capriles, has been effective in creating doubt among his supporters in the electoral process. He's led them to believe that there might have been fraud. In fact, his campaign announced that they had a quick count, which put Capriles ahead by some 300,000 votes, although the final results showed Maduro, and Nicolas Maduro, the government candidate, with a 240,000 vote lead. So indeed, this has created doubt among opposition supporters, and it has helped mobilize them to try to pressure the CNE to carry out this full recount.
And others have also recognized the outcome of the voting. The Organization of American States said it does support an audit of the voting, but recognizes Maduro as the winner. The Carter Center has called Venezuela's voting system among the best in the world. Yesterday, we had on the National Lawyers Guild on the program. They had a team in Venezuela during the voting. They called the process fair and transparent. But the U.S. has withheld recognition. The U.S. history in Venezuela goes back a long way. There was the support for the coup in 2002 that temporarily removed then President Hugo Chavez from power. A secret U.S. Cable was published by WikiLeaks. It showed that a former ambassador to Venezuela, William Brownfield, outlined a plan to infiltrate and destabilize Chavez's government. Talk for a moment about that context, about the U.S. involvement in Venezuela.
Well, yes. I mean, so there was hope for a change when Obama was elected. But unfortunately, we haven't really seen much of a change, certainly in terms of rhetoric. We also know that the government has continued to support opposition political organizations in Venezuela. And they have consistently supported the opposition's various campaigns, including this last one. So whereas in December and October of last year, when there were national elections that were held, the Venezuelan opposition really said that they trusted the electoral system and would recognize the results, and indeed they did. The U.S. Followed suit. In these elections, the U.S. has again followed suit with the opposition, except that this time around, the opposition has made claims of fraud and again is demanding a recount. And, you know, ultimately the opposition has said that they will not recognize President Maduro, won't recognize his legitimacy, and the U.S. has done exactly the same thing. The U.S. is completely isolated in the world in this position. There's no other government that has taken this position. Spain briefly did, but then backtracked about 24 hours later.
Alex Main is Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He joined us to discuss the outcome and response to the Venezuelan election. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Mountain View, California, I'm Dorian Marina.